Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. A narcissistic professional photographer lived a dangerous double life as a serial killer. He'd focus his rage on prostitutes mostly. It wasn't uncommon for him to bring them home, then try to explain why they were there to his wife. Sexual urges met, the killer would strangle his victims and dump their bodies in places he knew the police would eventually find them. The evil murderer needed the world to know that he was smarter than the police, and women meant nothing to him but unnecessary sexual inconvenience. Then, by a stroke of chance and aggressive police work, the wheels of justice stumbled upon a lead. It's nothing more than a lined sheet of paper that read list of 10, but shortly after its discovery, a task force was created and a serial killer was nabbed. This book is about the victims he left behind, not the person who took their lives. I will never condone such actions, nor will I try to rationalize behavior. He will go to his grave, hopefully sooner rather than later, knowing the identity of 4 women from his fabled list of 10. It's a sick way of showing people he's still in charge. His name is Joseph Nasso, and this book will grip you from the beginning and won't let you go until the final word. The book we're featuring this evening is List of 10, The True Story of Serial Killer Joseph Nasso, with my special guest, journalist and author C.L. Swinney. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, C.L. Swinney.
Hey, thanks a lot for letting me come on your show. I'm a big fan, so it's kind of cool to actually be on the show.
Well, thank you very much. This is an incredible story, a serial killer I knew nothing about. So thank you for an incredible story and introduction to a very, very colorful serial killer, Joseph Nasso. Now, let's start with, without giving anything away, just briefly, how did you come to be the author of this book? How did you come to want to write about Joseph Nasso? Tell us about that.
So I've written several other books about serial killers and had just come off my 8th book, and I was looking for targets to write about in the San Francisco Bay Area. And I've been in the Bay Area for almost 25 years now, and I had never heard of this case myself. But basically I was doing some research on serial killers in California, and this Mr. Nasso's name popped up. And as soon as I started reading some of the details of the case, just that I could glean from the internet, I was hooked on the case, mainly because what I kept reading was his victims were prostitutes, and a lot of stuff that came out about the case was just kind of categorizing women in a light that I wasn't a fan of, especially prostitutes. My background is law enforcement, and so I've dealt with and worked with prostitutes in the past, and I know them to be people. And so this case is mostly about victims that were prostitutes, and I thought to myself, you know, it's a local case. I have access to data and stuff that I'm going to need to write a good, solid book, but I could also try to track down the victims' families and try to paint a picture of the victims and give them a voice. I mean, that was my goal all along. So that's kind of what drove me to get involved with this case.
And you certainly do bring to life, pardon the expression, but you bring these victims to life in terms of creating real characters rather than what you might get from the newspapers. So you start off this book, you open the book in Oakland, California, on January 9th, 1977, and you introduce Roxine Rogash, and she has a boyfriend named Benjamin Bennett, boyfriend/pimp. So tell us this about her and her son Shane, and just what she was really like, what she had experienced in her life, and how she was, how she got to this position in January 1977.
Yeah, so Roxine kind of became the focal point of the book, and it was largely because I just was compelled to dig deeper and find out about her life. And every time I learned something new about her and her life, it just kind of made it, it was sad. It was sad to hear. It was sad to see how her life played out. And ultimately it led to her demise and being a victim. But she was also the first victim of Joe Nasso. And so her story is pretty sad as far as her family life. She grew up in a home environment that was described by her brother and half-sister as violent. There was a lot of violence in the house. Her mother beat the children quite a bit. She beat all the kids. She didn't really single out any of her siblings. But Roxine was the victim of quite a bit of physical abuse, not sexual that I could determine, but physical for sure. And then her biological father passes away. And then her mom remarries, and this guy is just as abusive as her biological father was. So she was a fighter. She found herself leaving the house and eventually running away from the home, trying to get away from the physical and mental abuse that occurred in her house. And then what happens a lot of times when kids leave their homes, they end up on the streets. And, you know, it sounds crazy to say this, and I've been in law enforcement for 17 years, but sometimes the streets are more bearable than their own homes. And wow, that was kind of Roxine's thing. She felt more comfortable on the street than she did in her own house. Yep, that was her mom, and her biological father had passed, but her siblings were there, so she kept coming back to that chaotic environment. So she had a childhood that was extremely difficult. Then she was exposed to abuse, both physically and mentally. She experienced her father passing away, and then a new man came in her life, an adult figure, and he was also physically abusive. There was a lot of drug abuse in the home, a lot of alcohol abuse in the home. So Roxine just basically struck out trying to make her way in life. Unfortunately, when she did that, she ended up becoming a prostitute and running into what you mentioned earlier, Benjamin. Strangely enough, though, is Ben actually loved Roxine. And this whole story, when it starts to open up, and I started digging into her murder, Benjamin was involved with the case. At one point, he was considered a suspect, but he later helped actually with the investigation. So it went full circle for Benjamin. But when she was a prostitute, she ended up being courted by this Joe Nasso character. And at the time, he had already been with numerous prostitutes. He had committed hundreds of rapes across the United States and landed in the Oakland area, the Bay Area proper, and ended up with Roxine. And that was Joe's first murder. He paid her for sex. They had sex. Joe needed to try to strangle women to get himself aroused and to reach an erection. That was one of the, you know, more disgusting things about him, was that need to do that and overpower women to reach orgasm. But with Roxine's case, he did that, and then he strangled her and then took her body away. But he did it all matter-of-factly, very calmly. He knew of a place out in Fairfax, which is the north end of the San Francisco Bay Area, and literally disposed of her body on the side of a road.
Let's go back just a little bit, because I think it's much more dramatic, the introduction of your book, because we talk about, again, you capture the complexity of this relationship with Benjamin Bennett. You say he's a pimp, he's pimped other women. However, he really cares for her. It's different. She's 18 years old. She's got this son, Shane, when she was pregnant from prostitution. And at that night, Benjamin, as doing his job as a pimp, he knows where Roxine is. There's an address where he's going to go to Foothill Boulevard here. So she gets there, and you describe what she sees in this strange place and what she sees the photo. So tell us a little bit more, because it's fascinating as the introduction of your book to find out Benjamin is so close, people are so close to apprehending him on this one first murder. Tell us, as you do in the book, a little bit about this incredible scene.
Yeah, so Joe Nassler shows up on the strip over there in Oakland, and you know, and that was in the late 70s, and you still can find prostitution in that same area today in 2017, so not a lot has changed there. But a deal is struck. Basically, Benjamin gives the nod to the John, and at that time they didn't know who he was. They just knew that this John, which was Joe Nasso, John being the term used for people who solicit prostitutes, had been on the street, had been around and looking for women to pay for sex. And so he was a stranger, but not a stranger. And so Ben gives the signal, yes, you know, it's fine. And then he allows Roxine to go with Joe, and he knows he lives over on Foothill. But he doesn't know, or he thinks he knows where it is, but he ends up kind of making a mistake. So like you said, Roxine shows up, she gets into this apartment, and she's starting to see stuff that, and mind you, she's lived on the streets, she's been a prostitute, she's been exposed to things that the average person hasn't seen or heard of, and
right.
She gets into this apartment, and she's starting to see stuff that just starts to make her kind of wonder. And so the description of what was in the apartment, you know, specifically mannequins, women's clothing, like pantyhose, photos on like the coffee table of women that appear to be partially dressed. Some may even be unconscious. She starts to get kind of a feeling. There's gotta be that, oh my gosh, you know, what am I doing here? This doesn't seem right. But at the same time, she's seen a lot in her life, her short life. And she's also trying to close the deal, if you will, as far as making this transaction. I think she gets to a point where it's like, I got to get out, and it's too late. Joe Nasso has figured it out. She gets hit over the head and is, and this information I'm giving you is from the autopsies and stuff. So, you know, it's backed by medical support, but she basically gets knocked out over the head, and Joe has his way with her body. Basically, he allows her to, he kills her. He's now excited. He has his way sexually with her. And then he was hoping to get this shot. And what Joe was talking about when he says the perfect shot was he wanted to capture what a woman's face looked like when they knew that death was near, kind of a fear of, concern, panic, that kind of image is what Joe was trying to capture, and what was in a lot of those photos on that coffee table. So he doesn't kill her right away, but she ends up, Roxine regains consciousness, and now she's trying to just survive. And humans will do a lot to try to survive. She knows she's in the bad spot. She knows that this is not a joke. She knows it's not a sexual thing. This is a danger, like, I need to get out. And she considers and thinks about her kid, and you know, she's trying to get out. Joe starts yelling at her a lot, and he's just basically at a point where he hadn't really considered murder before, but he did this time. And he has a rant and rave telling her how she's, you know, just like all the other women, he's better than them, that kind of thing, which was kind of an undertone throughout the rest of the murders that he would commit. But at some point, he decides that I've got to kill this girl. And so he basically strangles her to death. And it's just, you know, it's a release for Joe. So he ends up murdering Roxine, and now he's got to figure out what to do with her body. But before he can even get that far, Ben
because time has passed, Ben is looking for Roxine, and he ends up getting over on the foothill, shows up, and he's demanding that Joe open the door. But the problem is Ben's at the wrong spot. And that, unfortunately, because he didn't know exactly where Joe lived or where he was, had this little kind of flop apartment, gave Joe the opportunity to get away, slip away. And that was what you were talking about being close. They would have discovered her killed, and Ben probably would have killed or brutally beaten Joe Nasso to, you know, because of what he would have discovered had he gotten into that house. And, you know, it would have been the end, hopefully, or theoretically, of a reign of murders committed by Joe Nasso. So it was just one of those things where destiny had connected Roxine to Joe, and then Ben almost trying to save the day and almost did it. And it just kind of opened up this whole case to years and years of him tracking these girls and killing them.
You talk about that because Ben has got an outstanding warrant, he ends up in the lockup for a month, and Roxine is not even reported missing for quite a while. And then you talk about him dumping the body in the San Francisco Bay Area, and then tell us what he does with police himself at the gas station. Tell us what happens after this in terms of what he does with the body and his interaction with police.
So the disturbance of Ben trying to break into this apartment to find his prostitute slash lover, obviously the police are called and the police show up. Joe slips out the back with the body in his car, and the police arrive and they detain Ben. They run him out. He's not telling them a lot. He's obviously not being upfront with everything as far as the nature of what was going on and what he thought might be going on, obviously, because of his quote-unquote career. And so they run him out, find out he has a warrant, so they take him away. At the meantime, Joe is going north. He's going northbound on the local major freeways. He crosses over 580, which is a major freeway in the Bay Area, and he's heading towards Fairfax, which is just kind of north, if you can imagine, of San Francisco. And he's making the decision, hey, I need to get rid of this body. But one of the main things he did quite a bit in this case, all except for basically one of the victims that he left behind, he believes that he's smarter than law enforcement and he's better than law enforcement, and he wants to leave the body in a spot where he knows it'll be found. And so he actually has a location off of Sir Francis Drake Boulevard. He takes it out. He goes, travels west towards the ocean. And there's a road out there called Lagunitas, and he drops Roxine's body there, and she's naked, and she's got some pantyhose wrapped around her and stuffed in her mouth, which will come back to full circle to help actually identify and convict Joe of these cases. But then he makes a phone call. So he disposes of the body, but he puts it in a spot where he knows law enforcement will, or somebody will stumble upon it and call law enforcement. But then he makes a phone call. I did not 100% confirm that the phone call was Joe Nasso. The investigators in this case from 1977 and from 2010 tried, but and Joe's never admitted to anything, so he's never going to admit to this phone call. But what happens is dispatch receives a call from a male caller advising, hey, I think I see a what looks like a body dumped on Sir Francis Drake near Lagunitas Road. And obviously from there, that's when this whole thing takes off. So Joe leaves the area. Law enforcement is called. A deputy comes out to the scene, and sure enough, he finds Roxine, and that just was the catalyst for the rest of this case.
Right. Now, what does Joe Nasso do? He has a habit of moving after he thinks there might be a little bit of, and he feels it necessary to move. But does he move, and what's his next step in the life of Joe Nasso?
Yeah, so he'll move around. In this particular case, he kind of stayed in the Bay Area, and remember that he's married during this time. So he actually
right.
has a wife, and so he's living a double life. And we often find in serial killer cases that these folks live double lives. And when people find out, you know, they just can't possibly believe that this person is the same monster that, you know, law enforcement is saying they are. So at the same time, he murdered Roxine. He was still living with his wife, but he also stayed in the Bay Area. He wasn't overly concerned that he was going to be caught because he thought he had left no evidence behind, and he was very meticulous in how he disposed of Roxine, and so he was under the impression that he wasn't in danger. So after a few months go by, he actually decides, hey, you know, I'm going to go out and see what's going on, you know, on the strip looking for another prostitute. And in this case, he stumbles across another girl named Carmen Cologne. And Carmen was another prostitute kind of working the same general area that Roxine had been working. And remember that throughout, you know, probably from the early 70s, even into the 60s, when local prostitutes go missing, not a lot is done. And, you know, I'm in law enforcement now. If somebody comes to report that their family member who's a prostitute is missing, we take the crime report or we take the missing persons report, but we really don't do much more after that. I mean, it's just these people are adults. They have travel. They can travel. They have access to money. It's very difficult to find them. So we don't list them as endangered or under suspicion, that kind of stuff. So with Carmen is the same thing, but Carmen had known, it seems that she had known or had relations with Joe a few times because she was getting involved with the photographs. So Joe also paid women and did not always have sex with them, but he paid them to take provocative photographs. And that kind of tied in his thing with the mannequins, the partially dressed mannequins, the pantyhose fetish thing that he had. And so he kind of, these photographs that we learned later were part of, you know, his fascination with women and stuff, these prostitutes, most of them, or a lot of them were the photographs. And so he picks up Carmen, he convinces her they strike a deal for sex, but he also convinces her that he can give her a little bit more money if she takes photographs. What he called provocative photographs. And so again, Joe has made a deal basically with this girl, with Carmen. And then he takes her out and to kind of a location up in the Oakland Hills, kind of a place, not like Lover's Lane, if you will, but a place where cars typically pulled over and you'd find some juveniles maybe kind of having their first kiss or whatever, right? And so Joe takes Carmen out there. She has no concern at that point. They start to have sex in his car. But Joe, as he's messing with, you know, as they're having relations, is thinking, you know, I think this girl is probably going to look good if I can get her in lingerie and wrap her in pantyhose and get her in those provocative photos that he's kind of always infatuated with. And so he takes her home. He convinces her to do that. He takes her home, and while he's posing her for these photographs, he's also kind of he's very manipulative, and he was also very very gifted at speaking. And so he would kind of manipulate these girls and convince them of what he was doing. And because they were getting paid, not much resistance was there. And so in this case with Carmen, he is having photographs with her. They start kind of having relations again, sexual relations. And he's working on tying her up with pantyhose. And at one point, she's unaware of the situation because of the moment, because of the situation and stuff. She doesn't really realize it. But he has been able to get pantyhose wrapped around her neck. And as Joe's just about to climax with her a second time, he starts yanking on those pantyhose with all of his might. He was in pretty good shape. being an ex-military guy and stuff, and he strangles Carmen with those pantyhose. And once again, he takes photos of her deceased body, and these photos are later found when this case is finally gets some wheels, you know, 30-plus years later. But then he's the difference between Roxine and Carmen is there's no pimp coming. There's nobody looking for her. And he takes a little bit of his time. He goes and showers, and then he heads out with another body that he's got to get rid of.
Now, you say August 13th, 1978, in the Contra Costa County, the naked and badly composed body in 100-degree temperatures, animals and insects taking their toll, a lot of decomposition, but they're trying to take fingerprints and skin from underneath the fingernails, and the police speak to her sister. So what is the next step for police, and what do they get, what little tidbit of information did they get from the sister regarding photography?
What happens is there's a report of there's a highway patrolman that heads out to Contra Costa area, which is off of one of the major freeways in the San Francisco Bay Area. You know, it would be east, well east of where Roxine was dropped. And there's a report of a cattle that's been shot. And at that time, there was a lot of ranches out there. And a highway patrolman is not really geared to deal with cattle shootings, but it's a supposedly a prominent cattle rancher type person, and he's making, you know, a call. And so somebody basically orders this higher patrolman out there, and he thinks he's looking for a cow, and he ends up stumbling across Carmen. And she is naked like the first victim. She's wrapped in, she has pantyhose on her and stuff. And so, but remember, that's a year later, and it's on a different side of the Bay Area, and it wasn't immediately connected to Roxine. But when the forensics folks come out, they are able to grab some evidence from underneath her fingernails, which they believe is going to be skin fragments from the attacker, because they believe she's been murdered. Obviously, the way she's been found, it's pretty obviously she's been murdered. And they also are able to find out that when they bring her back to the coroner's office, they're able to get her fingerprints and find out that she's been a they find out who she is, so they identify her as Carmen. They're then able to find records of her being booked in the Contra Costa County jail for prostitution charges. So they kind of start looking at prostitution and those kinds of things. And then through those records, they find her sister. When somebody gets booked into a jail, they often leave an emergency contact. Jail requests that so that if something happens to this person while they're in custody, they can call them and advise them of what's going on with their family member. Detectives are able to track down Carmen's sister. And she almost immediately knows when she sees these detectives that something drastic has happened to Carmen. And she knows that Carmen's, you know, she knows she's a prostitute. She knows Carmen's been given a black eye a few times, but she knows by the fact that these detectives show up that there's probably more to it. During the course of their discussion with her, after breaking the terrible news about Carmen to her, they start asking her about Carmen, and she starts telling them about how her sister was meeting with the guy that was paying her to take provocative photographs, and that she kind of had a creepy feeling about the guy, is how she described it, but you know, she needed the money, and Carmen's sister kept trying to convince her not to and said she would help her and, you know, kept working on that. But Carmen kind of liked the life. And so that was a lead, though, for the detectives, because now they know that she was a prostitute. They might have some DNA from the skin underneath her fingernails. And then, you know, there's a possibility that there's somebody out there taking photographs, provocative photographs of prostitutes. So they thought they might have some leads there.
Now, regardless of what they thought at that time, of course, as you say, and people might realize the case went cold, and they ruled her death inconclusive. So now Joe believed he needed to move, and so he heads to San Francisco. He attends photography classes at San Francisco State University in the late 70s. And you talk about his wife, Judith, and she wanted a divorce. And you also talk about his schizophrenic son, Charles. If there is any thing that person that he may have had some sympathy or empathy for, it seemed to be his son, Charles. So tell us what he manages to do and what kind of employment he gets and his new life or his life in San Francisco.
So, yeah, a lot happens after Carmen's body's discovered. Joe decides that although he believes he's well ahead of law enforcement, he's got to leave the area. And this fact that he was leaving the area was used against him to show that he knew what he was doing was wrong, and it kind of went against his some of his tactics he tried to use in court, trying to represent himself for this capital murder case. But he ends up getting a job. He ends up divorced from Judith. She knows he's up to no good. Doesn't know about the serial killing stuff at all, but she knows he's up to no good. They've had a struggling marriage for years. And so Joe takes up a job for an apartment manager in San Francisco. And he knew the area, the Mission District area, very well because he had been taking classes out there for photography. And Joe was Joe is gifted with the camera, but he just chose to take pictures of things that you and I find we find it just disgusting. We wouldn't, you know, the normal person wouldn't like to see these kinds of things, but that's what Joe was taking photographs of. But nevertheless, he gets a job at a place, an apartment building at 839 Leavenworth Street in San Francisco. And why that's important is because it later connects Joe to the capital murder case against him. But while he's there, while he's still going to classes, he's still, his nose is still attuned to the street life, and he's still trying to get prostitutes to take photos with him. He's still trying to sleep with prostitutes. You know, that's what he knows. He's been doing it for quite a long time. And so he meets these people. He's running this apartment complex. He actually has an opening for an apartment. And while he's there, he gets somebody coming to his door. Her name was Sharia. She comes to the door and inquires about the apartment for rent. And it just something about her just really got Joe excited. And that was just the opening to another one of his killings.
Now, she's a little bit older woman, and so tell us a little bit more about Sharia and the predicament that she finds herself in this apartment.
So Sharia had just moved from Lake Tahoe area. She was living with her daughter, and her daughter got engaged, and they kind of had some disagreements about some stuff, and so Sharia was like, it's time for me to move. And also Sharia wasn't really she didn't want to get in the way of her daughter and her fiance and stuff. So she thought, you know, I've always wanted to move to San Francisco, so let me go to San Francisco. So she moves out there. She meets Joe. Joe gives her the apartment, agrees to rent it to her. And then Sharia starts looking for jobs. You know, she's looking for any kind of work she can find. She's retired from a career as kind of a secretary, if you will, in the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Office, actually. But she's just kind of a free spirit. She liked to go out. She liked to interact with people. She's now in San Francisco. She's got herself a little apartment, but she doesn't have a lot of money to spare. So she applies for various jobs. At some point, though, during this time, Joe starts wooing her. He starts trying to court her. She's not interested in that kind of relationship with him. But she's also slightly becoming desperate because she's falling behind on rent and she doesn't have a lot of money coming in, and Joe capitalizes on that. In his way that he could, he manipulates the situation and convinces Sharia to take photographs, and he would pay her, but not provocative at first. He just convinces her that there'll be, you know, professional photography, headshots mostly, convinces her it'd probably be she could use those to help her find a job. And so she agrees. Hesitantly, she agrees. The money was too good that Joe was offering. And over the course of a period of time, she starts letting Joe take photographs of her in suits, like professional outfits, nothing sexual in nature at all.
Now, he's a persistent person, so tell us what happens to her and how do friends discover that she is a victim?
So Joe convinces her to take photographs. He keeps trying to give her a lot of wine. He's trying to get her to get drunk. He starts developing feelings for her. Basically, there's some characteristics about her that reminds him of his ex-wife. She's older than all the prostitutes in the area. She's sophisticated. And Joe just really keeps trying to come on to her, have a relationship with her, and she keeps shutting him down. But she does eventually pose, and he does pay her for some slightly provocative photographs. And Joe's just head over heels for her. And while they're taking these photographs, and some of it was provocative, he's falling for her and he wants to be with her, but she keeps denying him. And eventually Joe starts to get frustrated. He has several sessions with her. He starts thinking about having relations with her, and if she won't willingly do it, that he may have to either put drugs in her wine or maybe have to, you know, take it from her unwillingly on her half. So they go back and forth. They keep working. Joe keeps working on trying to get with her. And then eventually he just basically wants to pay her for sex, and she just gets extremely appalled, doesn't want to do that at all. And he sees, like, he's getting close to having relations with her, and she looks at her watch and she leaves and says, "Hey, I got to go." And she just lives up the, you know, upstairs, and so it's pretty easy for her to get home, and so he lets her go. So she's kind of like flirting with a potentially dangerous situation that she's not completely aware of. So she makes it out of the house that day, or that apartment that day. And then he starts working on getting her to take photographs with these pantyhose, which was similar to what he was doing with Carmen and Roxine. And then finally, he basically tries to get the upper hand on her, if you will, and start to tighten down on some pantyhose and strangle her, but she fights it pretty well. She makes it to the floor, but unfortunately Joe just overpowers her and strangles her to death. And once again, he finishes what he's doing. He goes and takes a shower, and then he concocts a plan on how to dispose of her body.
Okay, we're going to use this as an opportunity to stop just for a second to talk about our sponsor, Smile Direct Club. Smile Direct Club straightens and brightens most smiles for 70% less than other companies' aligners or braces. Working directly with state-certified dentists and orthodontists, Smile Direct Club ships you custom invisible aligners right to your door in convenient monthly shipments, saving on in-office dental visits. Now, 70% less than other brands or braces, but you could save even more with insurance or a PSA. Many companies reimburse for a portion of invisible aligner costs, and Smile Direct Club accepts PSAs. There's also two easy ways to pay. Single pay is $1,700, and the lab costs are waived. Other aligners cost $5,000 on average. The second option is with Smile Pay. $250 down and $99 per month for 17 months, with the total being $1,933, with no credit check required. You can get started now with an in-home impression kit for only $95, and it's covered by our guarantee. If your aligners aren't a good fit for you, you get all your money is returned. With this special offer, you can now save 50% off the evaluation cost. And you can also visit a smile shop where they'll take a 3D scan of your current smile, and then you can see a preview of your new future smile. Now, I've started with the impression kit Smile Direct Club sent me, and I followed their incredibly easy directions. It took just 30 minutes. Save 50% off the cost of that impression kit and the evaluation, pardon me, by visiting smiledirectclub.com/true. That's smiledirectclub.com/true. And this is unavailable in North Carolina. That's smiledirectclub.com/true. Chris, we were talking about Joe Nasso's next move. He, as the manager of this apartment building, naturally he is questioned by police. He's evasive, and nothing he says, nothing that he has done, no information leading the police to lay any charges or suspect him in this murder. So what does he do next?
Yeah, so he skated that because he was actually interviewed by detectives about that murder because Sharia's body was found later. Close by in Tiburon, which is just across the Golden Gate Bridge from San Francisco. But Joe, because he was questioned, he once again believes he's completely in charge of the situation. Nobody's going to figure him out. He's left no evidence. They got nothing on me kind of mentality. So he basically, although he's a little bit hesitant, he decides, I'm going to leave the area. At first he wasn't, but he decides to leave the area. And this relocation, he ends up in a place called Yuba City, which is north of Sacramento. So he's traveled a good amount of time east and north. It's about 2.5 hours or so from San Francisco. So he's moved on, and he's found a place to stay, and he's kind of getting rooted to the Yuba City area. He's spending time in the downtown area, and this was in 1993. So we went from 77 to 78. Now we jumped into the 90s, and now we're in 1993. So we're talking time is going by, and law enforcement's gotten nowhere with 3 cold homicide cases. So he gets into Yuba City, and he knows how to pick out prostitutes. He knows how to find the underbelly of a community, if you will. And in April of 93, he ends up meeting a gal named Pamela Parsons. And Pam was a woman that was a local, and she was actually a waitress. But Joe, when he saw her, believed that she may do other things on the side, and he convinced himself that she may actually be a prostitute, or at least somebody that he could film, because he's still looking for that one shot, that perfect photo. It's similar to the surfers talk about that, the wave, they call it that one wave that was just the most perfect wave for them. Joe's looking for that perfect photo. So over the course of a couple of weeks, he starts going to this restaurant quite a bit and strikes up conversations with Pamela, and they sort of become friends. But the whole time, Joe's trying to figure out what's Pamela's real story? Would she maybe take money for sex? He's attracted to her. Or maybe he would let, or she would let him photograph him. So he's locked into another target, basically. He's convinced himself that one way or another, he's going to have relations with her.
And what goes wrong? What if anything, is a motivation for him to kill?
With all these women, it was this feeling that women are inferior to men, and they're especially inferior to him. The strange part is he was married, and he never abused his wife, and then she divorced him, taking the power and control away from him. So you would think that would have been one of the key reasons, but we don't know precisely why he did these killings, other than what he's been willing to share, but he's very circular when he talks. I communicated with him over several months. I was going to meet him personally, but He's in San Quentin, and that's a short ride for me, but he started trying to manipulate the situation. He started wanting to have money, and it was pretty obvious he wasn't going to actually tell me anything that I could use to help me with my list of 10. And ultimately, what I was trying to do before this book was to find out who the other four were on his list and try to get some closure for some families. But with Pamela, she makes the mistake of telling him that she's kind of down on her luck and she hasn't paid her rent. So he ends up convincing her to take money for photographs, the same he's done before with these other girls. And once again, basically he does the same thing. It's like he's on repeat mode. He strangles Pamela and then decides he needs to get rid of her body as well.
Now, he just continues. They find the body within a few days, 4 days later, you say. And what does that give police? We know these things are going cold, but tell us what police get, if anything, any leads from that whatsoever.
Yeah, they didn't get a lot of leads because she was kind of in a desolate area, but it was sort of off the beaten path, which was uncharacteristic of Joe because before it was very upfront. So I think subconsciously he was probably realizing that he needed to be careful with what he was doing so he wasn't spotted. But he tried to do everything he could do to make sure that there was no evidence there. And when the forensic folks came out to the scene, it was unfortunately frustrating for everybody involved because there was a human female body there, and she was obviously deceased, but there just wasn't like tire tracks or threads or DNA or just, you know, nothing that the investigators could grab and give to a detective and say, here you go, go get them. You know what I mean? And so they didn't really get a lot with hers as well, with Pamela's case. And because they didn't have a lot of leads to chase, and it left Joe out there, in a, you know, able to strike again, if you will.
Now you go to August 94. We'll come back to Sarah Dillon, and he is watching this woman for 2 weeks. This is another thing. He stalks these women. He watches these women, and then he keys in on these women and has it in his mind that he needs to have them. So you talk about a Tracy Tafoya. And again, he's talking about photos. So tell us about Tracy Tafoya and her photo session.
Yeah, so he does it similar to some of his other patterns. He does move from Yuba, but he just goes a little bit north, basically over the Yuba River, which is a short distance to a town called Linda. And he's just over there, and he's just lurking. I mean, that's what Joe did. He would sit and lurk. He would watch people for hours. And then he would just somehow pick something about these girls that would make them targets. So he's in Linda, California, which is just north of where he had just disposed of Pamela. And he's looking on the main drag for prostitutes, early evening hours, it's sunny outside and all that kind of stuff. And he ends up seeing this gal, and he didn't know her name at all, but Tracy was the one that he was watching for quite a while. And he also decided that he wanted to have sex with her. He did not instantly or in the beginning decide that this was somebody that he was going to kill. He was merely just basically trying to have sex with her. And he assumed, and it was correct, that she was a prostitute. So he sizes her up, if you will. They kind of start talking about having sex, but then Joe has that thought about the perfect photo again, and he just instantly starts talking to her about letting him tie her up and take these provocative photos. She agrees. She's looking to make money. She gets to this guy's house, and it's set up inside, like almost, you know, professional. There's lights and It's clean, but she also sees what Roxine had seen on the table, which is just hundreds of photographs laid out, and it's just pictures of women. And they're, you know, partially dressed. Some of them are naked. And she sees these photos, but she doesn't really give them too much weight because she's there to try to make some money, and it was good money that Joe was offering. And she agrees to wear some lingerie. She agrees to be tied up. And they kind of about barter back and forth, if you will. He then tries to offer a little bit more money for sex. She, you know, has no problem with that, decides to do it. And then he starts trying to really work on getting those, getting some pantyhose, you know, in a position that he could wrap them around her body, specifically her neck, so that if he wanted to, or the notion came across his mind to try to strangle her with those pantyhose, that he could. And sure as heck, he ends up strangling Tracy as well, and then dumping her body near a cemetery in the town of Marysville, which is just northeast of Linda.
Right. So let's fast forward here to, it's interesting too that he's on probation. This is, again, very, very important to this story, the role of probation officers and probation itself in this. So tell us the situation that why he's on probation and how it comes to be that he is in violation of that probation.
So Joe has been he's also been arrested for minor, very minor misdemeanor things, actually starting from the 60s. In the 60s, they were major. In the 1960s, he was arrested twice for once for rape and one for sexual assault, both of which the police basically let him go. And this is in the 60s, so you can bash police all you want, but in the 60s, things were done a lot differently than they are nowadays, and they basically ran him out of town, and that was the end of it. But later on in life, Joe becomes he has money. He's had some investments. He's made some money as a photographer. But he has this thing where he just can't stop stealing stuff. It's petty theft stuff. So he ends up doing several misdemeanors, and he finds himself on probation because he commits enough petty theft misdemeanors to basically be the equivalent of a felony. And this is before laws changed in California so that you could commit pretty much any crime and walk free now in California. But he's placed on probation. He's in California. He's now killed two girls, and he's deciding that it's time to go. And he puts in a request to have his probation transferred to Nevada. And what was happening, unbeknownst to his probation officer in California and to anyone else, Joe had been sneaking off, if you will, to Nevada and bought a place out there. I think it was on Medgar Street, which is on the outskirts of Reno. And so through a request he made, his probation was transferred to Reno. Well, in Reno, the Department of Public Services there, they're super aggressive, and they started doing spot checks on Joe quite a bit. And it really rubbed him wrong because he really loathed law enforcement, hates law enforcement almost as much as he hates women. And really starting to get frustrated by these surprise visits by his probation officer. Well, on one of these visits, the probation officer shows up unannounced and checks on Joe. And when he finds Joe at the house, he starts looking around the house, seeing some things that are kind of making him wonder what's going on here. The house would be something if you wanted to paint a picture of somewhat of a hoarder's house where there's stacks of things all over in corners on tables, in bookshelves and stuff. But he discovers that Joe has a advertisement in his shirt pocket for the sale or the purchase of a firearm, and that's prohibited by somebody who's on probation. The probation officer actually makes a phone call to the number on the the advertisement, and the person on the other end says, yeah, I talked to that guy. He was trying to buy my firearm. With that information, the probation officer arrests Joe and puts him on a violation and takes him to the local jail. For some reason, and I wasn't able to get exactly why or a really good solid answer as to why, but I was a probation officer at one time, and all I can say is that when you work in law enforcement, you get these hunches or gut feelings, but something about the situation at Joe's home in Nevada got his probation officer wondering and thinking, and he asked his coworkers to do a spot search, like a full search of Joe's house, which was not completely out of the normal, but he was being charged with trying to buy a firearm, and so the probation officer was looking for more evidence to support that charge, which would be a new felony charge for Joe. So he calls his buddies with the probation department. They show up, and they start searching the house. While they're searching the house, they're finding things that you and I just wouldn't keep in our house. Mannequins, partially dressed mannequins, rooms locked from the outside, like going down the hallway and the rooms locked from the outside. Piles of women's clothing, piles of pantyhose, just stuff that you really wouldn't see in a normal person's home, which starts kind of getting the hair on the back of the neck of these investigators, these probation officers, to stand up. Because of that, they dig further. Well, as they're searching the house for evidence of more crimes, because now they're convinced that Joe's up to no good, one of the probation officers finds this piece of lined paper kind of in a binder or a paper binder, if you will, or paper folder. It's a lined piece of paper, and it's handwritten notes. They don't know for sure at the time, but they assume it's Joe's writing. And it literally says on top of the piece of paper, the list. List of 10 is what it says on top. And then it just lists stuff like girl near Healdsburg, Mendocino County, girl near Port Costa, girl near Lagunitas. So it has these things, and then it lists one of them, number 7, was lady from 839 Leavenworth. And these probation officers look at that list, they look at the house that they're standing in, and they instantly feel like something is really bad with this list. They instantly assume the worst. They call Joe's probation officer at the jail and say, hey, you need to finish booking Joe, and you need to get back out here. And that was the catalyst for this entire case being cracked open, and what led to the actual apprehension of Joe Naso for 6 known murders.
You talk about the task force was formed quickly after this, and also what you call Joe's rape diary. Tell us where they found this, and we won't give it away, but what they found in there. I'm calling it rape diary. So what was contained?
Yeah. So obviously when they found that list, and when his probation officer showed up back at the house, they tore the house up. I mean, they just went through it. They opened doors, they unlocked doors. They went through a lot of the stuff in that house because his condition of probation allowed them to do that. Plus he was being arrested for new charges. In the same area where they found that handwritten note, they found a brown kind of leather book that would later be called or termed the rape diary, or Joe Naso's rape diary. And this thing had over 200 entries of descriptions of what Joe was doing to women and young girls basically throughout the country and even abroad when he was in the Air Force back in the 50s. And it was very damaging device. Book that was used against Joe in court. And with that rape diary, and it was very gruesome. It was very descriptive, and I didn't put any of that in the book because at some point you just got to stop. I just have a tough time providing some of these things, so I just don't include some of the details I feel are just not appropriate, even for a true crime author, unfortunately. But
wow.
Coupled, you know, with that book or the diary, if you will, and that list of 10 that they discovered, basically kind of panic sunk in, and everybody that was involved with the Nevada DPS essentially called in everybody. They ended up calling FBI. They ended up calling law enforcement. They put out kind of an email, if you will, to the detective bureaus throughout the California and Nevada saying, hey, we got this guy. This is sort of what we found. What do you guys think? Does anybody have anything to add to this? And although they had assumed that the list might be for victims, they just didn't have any proof at that time. So what ends up happening is start this, they call it the NASO Task Force. And so they basically try to make sense of that list of 10. And so they start assuming the worst, that it's probably murder victims. And they start trying to figure out what that little list, what little bit of information he put in that list, you know, that I read to you excerpts from and that are in the book, you know, they basically were able to build a case. And one of them that you should, that kind of should jog your memory is he literally wrote on that list, the one that he wrote, it says, what did it say? Oh, lady, number 7, lady from 839 Leavenworth. Well, if you remember, Joe was the apartment manager at 839 Leavenworth, and that's where Sharia lived when she was found murdered. So that kind of, that research and that kind of connection made the task force believe that this was a list of 10 murder victims.
What's fascinating about this, and this is somewhat unusual, and you don't get this all the time, is that Nazo is in jail on a probation violation and doesn't know anything about the investigation that's going on at the same time, and his narcissistic, overly confident behavior wouldn't allow him to consider it. So, but as you say in there, that this is really is a circumstantial case, so they're trying to build as strong a circumstantial case, trying to build as strong a case as they can in this year, in this very short year, to be able to take this to and make capital cases out of the evidence. So tell us about what goes on behind the scenes in that 1 year, and what does Nazo know about that?
Yeah, so you're absolutely correct. He had no idea. He was just kind of hanging out in custody. He knew that on the new violation, the probation violation and the new charge, that he was going to stay in custody for a year. He took it to trial and he lost. And so he was given a year, basically as a probation violation. That was the max amount of time. And you're right. The majority of what they had, what law enforcement had, was circumstantial evidence. But as they start picking apart that list of 10, a lot of people, by the way, a lot of people are involved with this case. I listed them in the book and tried to give everybody due credit, but you're talking about a massive investigation, so I may have missed a few people. But my main contact was a Marin County Sheriff's detective at the time named Ryan Peterson. He's now a sergeant there, but he took the reins because Marin County took a lot of ownership in this case because Roxine was the first victim that they were able to forensically tie Joe Naso to. And so because she was the first murderer, and it was the first murder that they tied to Joe Naso's list of 10, Ryan and those guys took over. They didn't necessarily take over, but they had a stronger lead into this case. And then Joe ends up meeting Ryan, and Ryan actually arrests him the moment he comes out of custody. But so what Ryan's able to do is, and I'm telling you, a lot of people are appalled with this case, but Ryan and that NASO task force were able to bring enough evidence, largely circumstantial, to the Marin County District Attorney's Office, specifically one primary DA, Rosemary, and convince her that Joe Naso was a murderer and that this list consisted of these victims that they were able to connect. And so it starts with Joe Naso's wife's DNA is located on pantyhose that were found inside Roxine's throat. And so that was like the deal breaker. That was the thing that just threw Ryan and the whole task force kind of in a frenzy, if you will, because now they had what they believed a confirmed murder victim and serial killer identified. It was his wife's DNA, but obviously it was, you know, a connection to Joe Naso because it was his wife. So it turns out the hair that he used that he stuck down Roxine's throat was actually a pair of his wife's pantyhose. But as they work down that list, they start putting together, you know, girl near Port Costas, Carmen Colon, girl near Lagunitas. Although it was misspelled, was Roxine. The Leavenworth address you and I talked about, there was one that said girl in Woodland, which was a girl we didn't discuss, but Sarah Dillon. The girl from Linda, which was number 9, which was Yuba County. And then the girl from Marysville Cemetery, which was Tracy Tafoya. So that's how they did it. But then they had to scramble. I know it sounds like a long time, a year is a long time, but when you're putting together a homicide case, then in this case, you know, a serial killer case that started in 1977, and you have 10 victims on a list, it's definitely not a lot of time. But they were able to get Rosemary, the DA from Marin County, to secure an arrest warrant for Joe for 4 murders. So Joe's sitting in jail. To bring this thing full circle, Joe's sitting in jail. His release date's coming up. He has no idea what's about to hit him. But he's released from the county jail and walks out and meets Detective Ryan Peterson, and about 8 other law enforcement officials. And he's just like, he's dumbfounded. He's like, what, you know, what are you guys, who are you and what are you doing here? And Ryan looks at him and says, well, I'm arresting you for murder. And he said, Joe responds with a chuckle, well, do you have cause? And Ryan says, yeah, we have cause and we have an arrest warrant for you. And he places handcuffs on him and puts him in the car. And then Joe doesn't say anything for quite a while. So he was very smug, very flippant, thought he was, you know, going to be free. He definitely thought he was going to get away with these murders. And now the moment he's released from custody for the probation violation, he's now being arrested and charged with 4 murders.
It's incredible, too, that dramatic scene that you have, and he doesn't have any idea. It's amazing how you capture that. But also in this, once he's arrested, police believe that, you know, the ultimate would be have a confession, have the person not ask for a lawyer. Explain the situation, though, that this guy has accumulated a lot of money. He's made enough money that he could certainly represent himself. And then you talk about 2 fortuitous things that he decides to do, one at trial and one affecting his bail. So his own representation, tell us about his decision on who to represent him at trial and how that impacts this case dramatically.
Yeah, as an officer, or I'm a deputy sheriff. I'm actually a sergeant now as well, and I've seen a lot of cases. I've been involved in a lot of cases over the last 17 years. And Joe made a critical error. He made a critical mistake. He is an intelligent guy. He's still alive. He's on death row. The guy is actually intelligent, but that sentiment that he was above all and above law enforcement and above women was actually his demise. And it was kind of interesting for me when I was looking at this case and corresponding with him, I was just thinking, you know, this guy was very close, extremely close to getting away with murder, with 10 plus murders. He does not give a confession. He adamantly denies everything about the case. He then later, because evidence is brought up, will change his story, but immediately he throws a curveball to Ryan Peterson and the DA, and he marches into court. He has the money to afford an attorney. He could afford a high-paying attorney, but he surprises the court by telling him, after they tell him he's being charged in a capital murder case and with the murders of four women, he says, "Thank you very much, and I'll be representing myself." And it just kind of shocked the whole courtroom. I mean, you're talking about seasoned investigators. You're talking about a judge who's been around a while, a DA who's been around a while. It's very uncommon for a person being charged for a capital murder case to represent themselves. And that was a crucial error for Joe, because some of the more damaging evidence actually came against Joe during the preliminary hearings and the infancy of his court case. So had he had a normal attorney, probably any attorney at this point, in my opinion, if he had just any attorney at all, he likely would have been released on bail because the case was all circumstantial. So because the DNA from Roxine was not known at that point. They would get it just a few weeks later. But Joe had the ability to hire an attorney, did not. He wanted to represent himself because he thought he was what he said was he was representing himself because he had a few small claims courts appearances and he won. So he felt like he could handle a capital murder case. I mean, that's his mindset. That was his mentality. So, you know, small claims court cases are vastly different than capital murder cases. And so that pompous attitude is what really hurt Joe. So consequently, he stayed in custody the entire time. And in doing so, his lack of knowledge of how the court proceedings work prolonged the case, which then gave law enforcement even more time. And they even did things like they exhumed the body of Tracy, I believe, and were able to conclude that her death was actually a murder. And then some evidence and stuff from that scene was used against Joe. It just all worked against him by simply not letting a normal attorney represent him.
Now, some people fare pretty well. Obviously, we know the end result here, so he didn't do well at all. But you say that he was rather, even surprisingly, despite his intelligence, incredibly inept at trial, missing all kinds of other opportunities. Again, very fortuitous for the district attorney and everyone else involved.
Yeah, he totally blew things in court. And then what happened... One other thing that really hurt Joe in court was because the reactions of the people in the courtroom to when Joe was making these blunders and when he was communicating with the judge or with witnesses, because remember he cross-examined witnesses for this case and he brought in some people that he thought would be character witnesses for him. Because people were kind of chuckling, kind of like rolling their eyes, like, look at this guy. Look at, you know, Joe started to get angry. And the violence and anger that he had when he killed his victims began to show up in court. And he would have violent, extremely violent outbursts and call the district attorney, the detectives in the room, and the judge just terrible names. Go on a rampage and scream and call him names and bang his fist. And so it actually was another example of how he had no control. And the one thing Joe Nasso always wanted to have was control. And so it kind of crumbled. His whole kind of machismo and the narcissism and all that stuff started to fade away because he thought he was in control and he was losing it in the courtroom. And so it really worked against him. The jury saw that and just was convinced without a doubt that this guy was violent and angry enough to kill somebody.
This was obviously dramatic for police and all the police that live with this case for a long time, and also people like Roxine's brother, Larry. And you talk a little bit about Larry's journey through this as well. So just tell us a little bit about Larry's story in this, and if you could.
Yeah, so Larry was a huge proponent of Roxine. It was his kid sister. He loved her tremendously. When detectives came and talked to him, when they figured out who she was, when she was found, you know, he knew something was wrong with his baby sister, and it hit him really hard. I mean, it hits everybody hard, but Larry kind of wished that he had been the victim. You know, he was that distraught about the situation. He came to court every day. He did provide information to law enforcement that was helpful, but he also became kind of a pain at times when he came to court, because he would posture, he would do things, he would say things to the media and stuff, and he even went as far as he had this large Bronco, a full-size Bronco, where he would write messages. He knew media would be coming to the hearings, and so he would write these messages on the side of his Bronco and stuff. But he was there every day. He gave his testimony. He was a huge proponent of the justice system and law enforcement, wanted closure for his family. And then when Joe was found guilty, you know, he had a quote of just, you know, hey, they asked him, well, what do you think now? And he said, I hope he just kills himself so he saves everybody a bunch of money and grief. He was speaking about NASO. So Larry was a huge asset for law enforcement. He kind of lost it a little bit during the trial, which can happen at any time, especially when you lose a family member and details come out about these cases. But overall, he was a big help for law enforcement. So, and he felt a pretty strong sense of closure when Joe was found guilty. So that was kind of a good thing to see and hear about this case.
So you talk about the list of 10, and he was convicted for 6 or 4?
He was convicted of 4, and 2 of them were tied to him and used for the sentencing phase of his case.
And that's, we forgot to mention that one of the circumstantial evidence, very strong evidence, is that a passport for a woman named Sarah Dillon, who was murdered in 1992, was at his property. So explain how these two women were not solved murders, but yet influenced his sentencing.
Yeah, so strangely enough, Sharia Patton, even though she lived at that apartment complex with him, Joe was not officially charged with her murder. Officially, right. He was charged with Roxine's, Carmen's, Pamela's, and Tracy's. So Sharia was not used as a charging, but used at the sentencing hearing. The other one was Sarah Dillon, and Sarah sort of fit the mold of the girls that he was interested in. She was out in the area where when he moved to Yuba City and Linda and that area, she was out there. Sarah was a huge fan of Bob Dylan. Her real name was actually Renee Shapiro, but she went by the name of Sarah Dillon, which was the name of Bob Dylan's wife. So she was a huge fan. Some would say a little bit over the top, but she was harmless, but she was a huge fan. Her skull was found. Law enforcement was able to figure out the identity of the skull by tracking down Sarah's biological mother. And then when this case broke and the police served a search warrant on a couple safe deposit boxes that Joe had, over $140,000 in one of them. But in one of the other safe deposit boxes, they found her passport, and they also found a Bob Dylan pin that she wore religiously, like every single day, all day. And so those two pieces of evidence, although circumstantial, we knew Joe kept trinkets from his murders, were used to convince the jury to seek the death penalty against Joe.
And so the fate of the other suspected cases from the list, any progress at all? Any hope for progress? What's the status?
There's no hope. And I hate to even admit that, but I've swallowed that pill for a while now. Joe Nasok sits on death row, believing that he is innocent, believing that he had nothing to do with these murders, and believing that, oddly enough, that he's still in control. It's my belief that he holds on to those four victims because that's the way he is. He's kind of like that kid that takes his ball and walks away. He's pouting. He's sitting on death row, still shocked that he was convicted of these murders. My intent when I was sending letters back and forth, and when he started to get I don't know if this makes sense, but it seemed like the way he was talking to me in the letters, he became more agitated when I was trying to get information about these cases.
Sure.
One thing that was noted by Ryan, the detective who arrested Joe and testified and brought that case to court, was the angle of saying, "Hey, Joe, just tell us, you know, who these girls were because we need closure," absolutely backfired. When Ryan tried to use that with Joe, and he had interviewed him for 4 hours at one point and then 2 hours a second time, when they got to that point where Joe would connect himself circumstantially to some of these victims, and then they would try to plead with him about closure and about the victims, Joe would instantly stop talking. So I think when I started asking him about these other girls on the list, it turned him off completely. In fact, he stopped talking to me. The letter stopped. He stopped talking to me shortly after I tried to figure out who these girls were. I had visions of grandeur. I had hoped that I could figure it out and close some cases for some agencies and bring some closure. But I failed. Unfortunately, it was one of the tougher parts about this story that I had to deal with and live with. But Joe knows. Joe absolutely knows where these girls are at, knows who they are, and he just won't give it up. So it's a shame.
Yeah. Well, it's not a shame that you've written this fine book, shed light on a incredible series of murders and rapes, history, a lifetime of rape and violence and then murder, and certainly looks like he could be responsible for a lot more than even 10, certainly. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about List of 10. For those people that might want to look at your other work, do you have a Facebook page, website? Tell us how people might contact you or check out your other stuff.
Yeah, if you type in my name, C.L. Swinney, on Amazon, the only person with that name, you'll see my work come up. And then on on Facebook, it's / C.L. Swinney. And I use that for everything, Twitter, LinkedIn, everywhere I'm at, social media-wise, it's C.L. Swinney. And then I do a lot of giveaways and stuff on Facebook, so if you follow me or connect with me on Facebook, I tend to give out paperback and Kindle copies of my books, and usually I'll sign them. So
right.
If anybody's interested, look me up.
Yeah, it sounds great. I want to thank you once again, coming on, talking about List of 10, the true story of serial killer Joseph Nasso. Thank you very much, C.L. Swinney. Hope to talk to you again soon. Good night.
All right, sir. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Good night.